Hey everybody, it's Byron Perry here in Singapore, and we are back for another episode of the Coconuts Podcast. I am here with Vim, who is calling in from his house. How you doing, Vim?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. It's a rainy morning here in Singapore. You got asked to stay home for a little bit, right?
I did. Well, indirectly. So my brother was put on sort of a five-day watch list by his doctor, and he was advised if anyone else was living with him, they should be staying at home as well for about 5 days just to see if there are any symptoms or any of that stuff. He had the flu, and he still has the flu, but it's nothing more than that, thankfully. I think it's just a common thing that's happening now with any clinic or hospital visit that you go to. I think people are just being extra careful, which is definitely the right thing to do.
Absolutely. How are you feeling? Any symptoms? Can you smell? Can you taste?
Yeah, that seems to be the immediate test, right? No, I feel fine. I'm thankfully okay. But yeah, I think a lot of people now in Singapore, especially the numbers going up and up, we found new clusters this week. So yeah, it doesn't seem to be subsiding. So I don't know, there might be new measures potentially to sort of help manage the situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Always allegedly. Yeah. We got to use that word very liberally. Well, yeah, we got a great show for you today, guys. Actually, we're going to have an in-depth conversation with Vim, who has a very interesting background and working in film and television in Hollywood, in Singapore. And so we're going to talk about his background, the TV and streaming video scene in Asia, and what we have planned for our Coconuts TV video production this year. But before we get to that, let's talk about the top stories from across the region, from Singapore, Manila, Bali, Bangkok, Hong Kong, etc. Take it away, Vim.
Yeah, I guess there's no other place to start except with COVID-19. On March 30th, Singapore did their own version of clapping for our carers. Essentially, this was Singaporeans celebrating the people who do all the things for us during this time that, that might go unheard. So at 8 p.m. on March 30, around Singapore, people started clapping, applauding for medical workers, cleaners, supermarket employees, everyone who basically is keeping the country going, as a lot of us stay at home. So I think it was really sort of everyone is really appreciative. I think it was a good thing to show. It's a very minor thing, but I think it just shows people that we do care, that we're all in it together. Just a special time, special moment.
Did you do did you go out and clap on your balcony?
I did. I actually forgot that it was 8 p.m., but I heard the clapping going on outside. And then my brother and I, who live in an HDB area, we joined in. And yeah, it's one of those things that I think Singaporeans are not known for, sort of solidarity and sort of supporting each other. And so it was kind of a nice moment, I think.
Yeah, it was cool. I heard it in my neighborhood, Tiong Bahru. And I think in hindsight, I'm like, why didn't I join? But I just kind of listened to it and was like, yeah, that's cool. People got out, and my neighborhood is pretty low slung, with a lot of balconies and windows. And so you could really kind of feel that it was coming from all around, and it was cool to hear.
Yeah, it was nice. Certainly nice.
So meanwhile, in Manila, the top story this week was that Senator Emmy Marcos criticized President Duterte for his alleged slow response to the COVID-19 crisis. The reason that this was so surprising is that Emmy Marcos, who is the daughter of Ferdinand Marcos, who very famously allegedly embezzled something like $10 billion from the Philippine government while he was in power during basically, I think, the 80s. So Emmy Marcos has been a strong supporter of Duterte over the years, and really probably was a key aspect of his becoming president. So it was just very surprising that she publicly criticized him. On her vlog, she said, This is not the time to be stingy. The government should help the people unceasingly. Do it now, please. Stop with all these emergencies. These emergency powers are just scaring people. You can't blame them when they can't see that they're being given food, medicines, testing kits. So according to our editors, Keen and Rachel in Manila, the senator was clearly referring to Duterte and the emergency powers that had been given to him by the Philippine Congress. So definitely some sort of palace intrigue in the Philippines, the Marcoses, despite, I believe, there being some convictions over the embezzlement of money when they were fully in power, are still very, very powerful. And them criticizing Duterte is big news. And I'm not a Philippine politics expert, but I know that this is why this was such a popular story, that there's it's kind of some Game of Thrones type stuff going on over there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, I mean, yeah, as much as it's a pop political thing, it's still about helping the people, I think. I think that's what she kind of wants. And, you know, I think different countries are trying to deal with the situation in a different way. No one has a solution yet. So I think this is just one of those things where she's trying to call out people to help the people a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess like to switch gears a little bit. Do you know what Niepi is, Byron?
I do. Niepi is, I believe, the biggest holiday in Bali, whereby all of the businesses close. I believe they turn off the internet. Mm-hmm. I don't think the airport runs any flights, and everybody is meant to stay home, do nothing. And I believe it has to do with not angering the gods or giving a day of rest to the gods.
Yeah, so essentially it's a day of silence. Yep, it's to celebrate the Hindu New Year in Bali. So essentially people stay at home. If you are a foreigner or anyone else that's visiting, you tend to just stay in your hotel or place of residence and just chill for the day. But there was a dude who didn't really know about this and went running and was duly arrested and chained up. He was chained up and detained and told not to go anywhere, to find out why he was like running during this day and all this crazy stuff. So there was a video of this, so of a dude being chained up by the cops and being moved around. So yeah, it's kind of a crazy situation.
Yeah, the video went viral. They're not actually cops, I don't believe. They're more like local security forces, which are a whole different story in themselves that I believe have been covered in some documentaries, etc., because they're kind of a gray area between cops and normal civilians that will basically be the cops, for lack of a better word, in their neighborhood, and will do things like chain somebody up if he breaks Niepi and goes for a jog.
Pachalang, right? They're called Pachalang, traditional Balinese security forces.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, understandably, the video went viral. I think the guy was shouting all sorts of stuff, and either he pleaded ignorance or he purposefully violated Niepi. But I don't think he's going to do it again. I think he learned his lesson. I was actually, the very first time I went to Bali, this is how I learned about Niepi, which was probably about 10 years ago. I arrived the day before Niepi. And the day before Niepi, there's all these big parades of floats with, I believe, Balinese gods that are really crazily constructed and look very scary and are, I think some are eating people and stuff like that. Oh, so wow. It's a kind of a big street festival day. I think it's called the Ogo Ogo. And then the next day, nobody does anything. And so it was really cool because I just stayed in the hotel which I was staying at, which was kind of nice and had a little garden, just a little chill warung in the back streets of, I think, the Kuta or Seminyak area, and just had to stay there all day and have a day of total rest. So that was kind of cool.
Ah, I see.
So meanwhile, in Thailand, big news, last night, the Prime Minister, Prayut Chan-o-cha, went on TV to say that a curfew would be implemented starting tonight. From 10 p.m. to 4 a.m., I think for the foreseeable future, nobody is allowed to go out of their home or their residence from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. Thailand, obviously known for its nightlife, obviously a place where everybody loves to go out and about. So everybody is going to be homebound for the foreseeable future, and I think it's probably a good thing. What he said was, we must not be reckless. We must join hands. We mustn't allow infections to spread further. This depends on all of you. And he didn't announce any additional measures at that time, but he did say that anybody who violates the curfew will face up to a 40,000 baht fine and or 2-year imprisonment. So things continue to get more and more serious in Thailand.
Yeah, and I think this is just the start, right? I do believe that with Thailand doing this, I wouldn't be surprised if other countries kind of follow suit just to battle and contain the virus.
Yeah, absolutely. And so our most popular story of the week was from Coconuts Jakarta, which covered the fact that in a village in central Java, a few men dressed up as pochong, which are basically Indonesian zombies, dead people who are wrapped from head to toe with white cloth, as is customary in Islamic burial rites, and they're tied up so they can only hop. And these guys dressed up as these basically ghosts slash zombies and hid around corners and hung out in the square of this town to scare people into staying home and not violating whatever order was in place there, basically to stay home and not go out and about to, you know, fight the spread of the coronavirus. So the village's spokesperson, Anko Setiarso Widodo, said that residents have decided to self-isolate the village as a form of Gotong Royong, which is the Indonesian phrase for mutual cooperation in the fight against the coronavirus, and that no one is allowed in or out until normalcy returns. Together with other residents, the pochongs will check on anyone who passes the gate, including spraying disinfectants on people. The pochongs are only on duty at night while the residents guard the gate during the day, Anko explained. And so there's a video of this as well. I don't know if it was staged or not, but of the pochong guys freaking out some young men who were violating that order and being out and about on the street, scaring them. And I think that made it to the Korean news. Some large Korean TV channel we found a clip of used this clip and mentioned this story from Indonesia. So we joked in our editorial chat that we finally made it onto Korean news because we're pretty sure that they sourced the story from us.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's freaky, right? And I think they're onto something. If I was out at night here in Singapore or anywhere across Asia and I saw something like that, or if I saw like our version of it, like a Pontianak or a Sadako type creature, like our person walking around, I'm going to be at home. Like I am not leaving my house.
Absolutely. Desperate measures, desperate times. We need to freak people out. And if local zombie and ghost creatures are what is required, I think it's a very good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really. That was probably my favorite story of the week.
And it was the most popular story of the week.
Awesome.
So moving on from our top stories of the week, today, our interview is with Vim. Hey, Vim.
Hi.
Vim joined Coconuts earlier this year, I think in January, right, Vim?
Yeah, officially in January.
In January, as our Coconuts TV head of content and production, he's going to be leading all of the videos that we do at Coconuts this year. And we have a really exciting plan and suite of shows that we're going to be producing, both for our own YouTube channel and for prospectively broadcasters and streaming video services. Vim, tell us about what we have planned for our Coconuts TV originals on YouTube this year.
Yeah, I think this is an exciting year for us. We want to create as much content as possible, sort of experiment as well with different types of formats and different types of shows. We are known for our great documentaries and our great stories. Largely, we look for untold, very, I wouldn't say niche stories, but stories that really sort of provoke the viewer. And while we're going to keep that content going, those productions going, we're also going to delve into more lifestyle content where we talk about fashion, food, even delve into some reality content, which is a little bit more topical. So we're going to be creating a whole plethora of stuff, and I think it's going to be very exciting. I think viewers are going to get a chance to see a different side of coconuts, but also see content that actually they can engage with that matters to them.
Very cool. And we have a new show dropping today, yeah?
We do have a new show today. So it's called, should I give it away? Or yeah, should I keep it
absolutely
a secret? Yeah, drop yeah, it. It's a food show. It's called the Mukbang Mashup. It's about people trying different types of cool dishes and sort of telling us a little bit more about them. But also, like, I think it's just a way of having some fun and showing viewers all the different types of cuisine that we can find across Asia and around the world as the series goes on.
I think for those who don't know, mukbang is a very popular format of food shows where basically people just eat. And you'll often find it with, it comes from Korea, and you'll find whoever is the person doing the mukbang sitting pretty close to the camera with a humongous spread of food in front of them, and they will just eat it, and it'll take something like half an hour or an hour. They're talking while they're eating it, but there's also an ASMR element, which is, you know, kind of weird, frankly, I think, but just watching this person slurping on the soup or shoving noodles down their throat or, well, that sounded weird. or taking a bite of an apple, but the sensory, the sound and the, watching that person eat is a big part of it. Ours is a bit different, I think, and it's a little bit of a mashup of that type of mukbang with a reaction video because the viewers don't know what the food is. I mean, the subjects that we're shooting don't know what the food is. The food appears in front of them. They're like, oh yeah, I know what this is. And then they try it and they talk about it. I think I'm excited about that show.
Yeah. It's a little bit of mukbang. It's a little bit of tasting. It's a little bit of reaction. It's informational. It's informational fun. And I think we just want to show that we have a different side. And this is just a start of a whole bunch of new stuff that we're going to produce.
Absolutely. And so, Vim, you have a very interesting career that you've had. You worked for, I believe, Paramount Pictures and NBC Universal in Los Angeles, yeah?
Yeah, I did. So I started off actually in chemical engineering, and then I made the switch to go and do TV and content, essentially. So I started off in Chicago doing news. And so in a lot of ways, I'm coming back to that here being at Coconuts, but along the way, I moved into doing a lot of TV and some films, but really as a producer, and a lot of my career was built around, being in developmental programming, which is dealing with pilots. And, and, you know, we produce content where we had to sort of find investors, find the right idea, sell the right idea, and get sort of the right shows picked up and keep those shows alive. A lot of times they did not stay alive.
Sure. What was the percentage of shows that was a success and how did you measure success?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was just a personal thing. Like a lot of, if you're in that field of being in the pilot world, you have to get used to rejection and failure.
Yeah.
If you can't, it's going to be a very, very sad place. It's already a sad place. But I would say, like, you know, we went through, you know, before we even shortlisted shows, we would go through, you know, thousands of concepts. And maybe you have about 30 shows you kind of like. And, you know, the higher ups will say, okay, let's go do like 20 pilots or 15 pilots or whatever it might be.
And so this would be like at NBC?
Yeah, this was at NBC.
So you have you get 1,000 like treatments or scripts and then you pick 30 and then the higher ups say like, let's make 20 or something like that.
You say something along those lines. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in our industry, it's always about like, oh, someone else is something that's really successful. Let's try to do something similar. It's not always the most successful method of doing content, but then you're in the place where someone will say, well, they already did it. If we don't do something like that, we're not getting a piece of the pie. So there's a lot of formats that end up being thrown in because, you know, someone else is already doing it or a version of it. So for example, if there is the American Idol on one channel, there is The Voice on another channel. So that's sort of like a similarity in like formats. But yeah, so out of the sort of 30 potential shows, you maybe produce 15 to 20 pilots. Out of the 15, 20 pilots you do, you know, you show that to a test audience, you have upfronts, and then you maybe end up green lighting about 10 of them. So they go into a 14 episode order at first. Mm-hmm. And then so that's means
the first
that,
season.
Once yeah, for the first season.
You green light 15 episodes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's only for half a season. So that's half a season a lot of the time. And so as you produce that show, you kind of already know before the half season hits whether that show is going to be picked up for the full season. Some shows do get picked up immediately for a full season. But nowadays, I think just because it's a cost issue, it's usually a half season. So if the show's doing well, they, you know, get the full season. And a lot of shows get canceled. And
yeah.
I think unless it's a it's done by a veteran showrunner, for example, Dick Wolf, who does all the Law and Order shows. A couple shows that we worked with him on were the Chicago shows, Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, I think Chicago Law and Chicago Med. So there's four of them. Yeah.
Police,
I think Chicago,
Fire, Law, Med. What else can we do? What other segments?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think Law got canceled.
Yeah.
Like pretty much like right away. But yeah. And I think that's how some shows end up staying longer, even if they don't get like super great ratings, because they know that there's a great showrunner and great investors who will keep the show alive.
Yeah.
But a lot of shows don't even get that full season pickup. So you might end up having maybe three shows, four shows, get a full season order. And that's when they finish season one. And then they go into season two, and a lot of shows don't even make it season two. So they're done.
They'll do a first full season and then get canceled.
Yeah, then they get canceled. So then you go into sort of, you know, pilot season again, and you kind of do the same thing again. So, I mean, that's a very concise way of putting the journey in. But like, there's lots of different things that go into it. But yeah, it's not a very, it's a tough sort of job. It's a tough time because you kind of make a lot of friends, you make a lot of relationships, and you kind of have to say goodbye to a lot of people right away. Or, you know,
love
after a
you,
few months,
you're fired or you're canceled.
Yeah, because a lot of times, like, you know, there are great shows that don't last a season or, you know, don't even get picked up. And it's nothing to do with the people that are actually working on that show. Sometimes it is, I'm sure. But
and what was like the number one or the main factors in the deciding of whether this is worth continuing or canceling? Is it the purely the ratings, or is it the ratings and the advertising revenue that it generates, or is there any other factors that go into the decision making there?
Yeah, it's all of it. And on top of that, obviously in the last, you know, decade or so, we're moved away from, I wouldn't say just moved away, but Nielsen ratings were like the number one thing for the longest time.
Yeah.
And that's TV ratings in the States, I guess around the world, but in the States especially. But and that has sort of gone into adding, you know, like, is it being streamed as much? Is it being downloaded? Is it being watched after the fact? Are people recording on you know, TiVo, VOD?
Yeah.
And all that stuff. So there's a lot more numbers that go into it, a lot more data that go into it. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, if some exec is like, yeah, we don't want to spend too much on the show because it's too expensive to make, even if it has like sort of a loyal following, then, you know, that show gets canned. Like, a lot of it's just how much money can we make? How cheap is it? How cheap is the show? And if it's a marquee brand, like, you know, if DC or Marvel or, you know, like a known IP is put out there, then that show will stay, you know. But if not, like, you know, we're talking about network TV. We try to make shows. We don't have the budgets of an HBO or even a Netflix for that matter, which is weird to say. But yeah, we don't make crazy big shows. I don't think you could look at any of the shows on network TV and say that they have the production quality of, you know, a big production that's on Netflix or HBO. And I think that's a different, that's sort of like the playing fields that you're on. So
what was one of your favorite or most notable shows that you were involved in the development and production of?
A lot of shows. I think the shows that I remember best are not actually the shows themselves, but actually the people. And, you know, you tend to have great relationships with people after. And it's at the end of the day, it's a relationship business. So, you know, you tend to want to work with the people that, you know, you can depend on and who are, you know, supremely talented. And, you know, they always have great ideas that, you know, they can sort of not only pitch, but also execute. I think that's the biggest thing in that world. And also, I guess, in our industry in totality, like if you can pitch what you want to pitch and execute what you want to pitch, I think that goes a long way.
That's you know, the whole
I
thing.
Think, yeah, ideas are great, but if you don't know how to get them going, I think that's, you know, it's a whole other ballpark. I think that's like next level.
Sure. But there's got to be some shows you can mention. What, for the listeners out there, what's a notable show you worked on or that you, your favorite show that you worked on during your time in LA?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chicago shows are still pretty dear to me because they were kind of, and I was already leaving NBC at that point. But I think kind of going back a little bit kind of going back home in a lot of ways, because I spent a lot of my time in Chicago growing up and, you know, going to school and working over there. So I think that was sort of my favorite part of it. I think just going back to that, it's a fun city. And
yeah.
I think, and you know, obviously we had a great cast that we found from, all over Hollywood, but we also had a great cast that was from Chicago, people who are like sort of veteran and character actors who, you know, were, you know, quite prominent in Chicago. And I think, you know, it was kind of fun to have that flavor, that local flavor, and, you know, talk about, you know, all the little nooks and crannies of Chicago that no one would ever know about. But if you're from Chicago, you would know.
The so local I think color. That was,
yeah, like local corners, bars, restaurants, food, you know, deep dish pizza, the Cubbies, you know, all that stuff. So I think it's just like, that was a cool, fun show. And I wish, like, you know, if I had stayed longer, I would have loved to have, you know, worked in that show a lot more.
Sure. Where's the best hot dogs in Chicago?
Ooh. Well, I would say, well, there used to be a place in Roscoe Village, which is kind of north, uptown, Chicago. So near Lincoln Park, actually kind of near Wrigley Field. And they had, all types of, hot dogs. They even had a, what is the goose, a foie gras.
Oh.
They had a foie gras sausage hot dog.
Interesting.
And yeah, and like I think Anthony Bourdain, when he's alive, RIP, did go over there to have the foie gras hot dog. So it was quite a famous place. But my favorite place was still, I mean, as cliche as it is for any Chicagoans listening, was the Wiener House. The Wiener House,
yeah,
is a really
isn't that sort the of place free- where the people who work there yell at you?
Yeah, they do yell at you, and it's like a 3 a.m. hot dog. You can't eat it any other time except then after like a night out. And yeah, it's so Chicago, because a lot of people are waiting for a hot dog in the winter. It's an open, it's sort of a kiosk. So like you just walk up and you eat outside in the winter, like, you know, with a hot dog.
Yeah,
and get insulted.
Get insulted. So yeah. What are the type of things they say? Like, is it like full on very vulgar, or is it just you're an idiot? What are the type of things that they say to customers?
Yeah, all of it. Like, you know, hurry, you know, like they'll say hurry up, or, you know, decide quicker. I mean, I'm making this super PG, like just add a few more colorful words to that. But yeah, like, you know, you're wasting everyone's time. You know, and yeah, I think like when they get to know you, they see the same people again, they'll start making fun of you a little bit more. But it all comes from a place of love. And, you know, they're always fun ladies. And yeah, it's one of those things where if you are in Chicago, if you are a Chicagoan, like that's quite a classic place to go get a hot dog.
Absolutely. So shifting gears a bit onto now you're in Singapore working for us and leading Coconuts TV. For those that don't know, we produce videos not only for our own YouTube channel and social media, but also for broadcasters and streaming video services. We have a docuseries called Highland that is about marijuana legalization in Thailand that is currently on Netflix. We produced a show for iFlix called Coconuts TV on iFlix with weird and wondrous stories from across Southeast Asia. We produced a documentary called Nagaland that we sold to Discovery Asia, which was kind of a travel adventure documentary about Nagaland, this very remote and interesting part of India. So there was big news this week that Hook, which is the OTT, basically run by Singtel, but also I believe had investment from Warner Brothers and Sony. That was quite surprising for everybody, I think, because it had these really big name investors. Singtel is the biggest telco here in Singapore, I believe, and a massive multi-billion dollar public company. What were your thoughts on that? And what do you think? I mean, this is a very complex question, but everybody talks about right now in the streaming video and TV industry, the streaming wars. Everybody has launched a streaming video service. Netflix is the original gangsta. Then Amazon came up and Hulu. And now in Southeast Asia, we had Hook and iFlix and View, which is based in Hong Kong. Every single big U.S. network, NBC, Warner Brothers, HBO, they're all launching their own streaming video services. Yeah. What do you think about Hook's folding here in Southeast Asia? And what do you think people here are watching and want to consume?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, obviously, it's kind of sad that, you know, we lose something that's from Asia, even though it's funded from overseas. But
well, I think it's funded partially from overseas, but mainly from Singtel, I believe.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's always sad when, you know, people like lose jobs and stuff like that. But but the reality of the situation is that, you know, streaming wars, as you said, is really kind of a throwback to the network wars, you know, on TV. And now it's not just in the US, but it's global, right? And with a VOD platform and an OTT platforms in Asia, I just think it's tricky because you have so many different countries, so many different languages. And I think that now a lot of people are realizing, especially after sort of iFlix and Hook now, that leading with Western content, with leading with Hollywood content or foreign English content is not the way. Like, I think a lot of other OTT platforms like Voo, and I think there's a whole bunch of them in India as well, Hotstar. Which I think belongs to Disney.
Hotstar is successful. They're doing well. But go on.
They create great content for their market. And I think having one sort of solution for all of them in one place is ideal. But, you know, it's very language driven. It's very localized. So I think to celebrate like Asian content and localized content would be the way to go for a Asian OTT platform.
Yeah.
And I think if that's how they can sort of do a few things. One is encourage new content creators, celebrate like great content creators in Asia, and also find like, you know, great stories to tell that are sort of more that resonate. Because the reality is that we're always going to have Netflix. No one's going to cancel Netflix to have a Hook or iFlix or anything else that you know, sort of English based. No one's going to do that. And you know, as we see Disney coming in with Disney Plus, you know, Hulu's now international. It hasn't rolled out in Asia yet, but that will be here soon. Warner is going to have their own, you know, sort of platform. HBO Go is already here. So the reality is that, you know, there's all these platforms with great shows having English content. So I think if there is a VOD/OTT platform that's going to be successful in Asia, they need to sort of work on localizing their content and creating great big productions with locals.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really interesting conflict that any company has that's trying to make content for multiple countries across Asia.
Yep.
Is the conflict mm-hmm. between localization within each market and universal content that travels.
Yeah.
Because there is content that travels, you know, and Marvel and, you know, American movies are still absolutely massive and definitely by far the most popular things that people are watching. A lot of them are Hollywood movies in all of the countries that we cover.
Yeah.
But, yeah, at the same time, there's a lot of, beyond that very high level stuff, people do want to consume super localized stuff that's relevant to them and made by people from where they're from. It's something that we wrestle with at Coconuts. You know, we've experimented with launching local language versions of Coconuts in Indonesia and in Thailand. They didn't really take mm-hmm. off. And it was funny because a lot of Indonesians and Thai people would tell us, why the hell are you doing that? Like, I don't want to read your content in Thai or in Indonesian. The whole point I like it is because it's in English. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics with the conflict between localization and universal content that's regional. But I do think that above all, and if, this is kind of a cliche, but it's about having great storytelling and great content. And
yeah,
there's a lot of stuff that crosses borders still. And I was looking at, for example, on Netflix, the top, they've now added top in your country. You notice that? Like top 10 within Singapore. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have.
There's a little module. And of course, it was big news when they came out with that because Netflix never releases any of their viewership data. And they haven't released how they formulate the top 10. So who knows? It could just be obviously the stuff they want to try and get you to watch, which is usually Netflix originals. But I noticed that in the top 10, a vast majority of them, I think like 5+ in Singapore, which is where we live, were mm-hmm. Korean shows.
Yeah.
So that's another example of, obviously Korea is famous for amazing K-pop shows and movies. And now Parasite won the best picture. So it's there really at the top of their global buzz and game.
Yeah.
But I didn't see any Singaporean productions in the top 10. And mm-hmm. there is some Singaporean stuff, I believe, on Netflix. So I think, I don't have any specific answer or recommendation as to what strategy works, but I think both mm-hmm. do work, and you do definitely need some local stuff to succeed, which I don't know how much Hook did that. I know iFlix has pivoted to that and is really trying to do a lot of local language content in Indonesia, for example. Singapore obviously is a unique market because it's so small and so mm-hmm. wealthy. And so it is English speaking much more than other markets nearby. Yeah. How much do you think, like, I don't want to get you in trouble, but how much, like, how much do you watch Singaporean stuff?
I do when it's trending.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not a big viewer of local content
only
because I don't have MediaCorp channels on my, you know, on my TV.
Yeah.
But, you know, like something that's on Netflix or that's accessible on YouTube or something like that, then it's largely YouTube content would be the biggest amount of, you know, local content that I watch. And certainly like anything on a VOD platform or OTT platform, you know, for example, Singapore Social, that kind of stuff. Certainly I'll watch that.
What did you think of Singapore Social? Give me your soundbite review. Again, I don't want to get you in trouble, but.
I think, for me, it's a different scenario because I do know some of the people on that show.
Yeah. So you gotta be more careful.
Yeah. No, I like I said before, like I didn't, you know, a lot of people hate watched it, but I think I watched it with a different viewpoint. I didn't think it was very interesting. I know a lot of people are really kind of mad about, oh, you know, like this is not an accurate representation of Singapore. But these people do exist, you know, like I know these people, not them specifically, but I know these types of people. So it's not as though they're not Singaporeans. So people who question like the authenticity of that part of them not being Singaporeans, they are Singaporeans.
Yeah.
But also, I don't think like it was especially gripping. I don't think the storytelling or the producers did them a favor.
Yeah,
that's what I can say.
And they were American, right? The production It was done by an American production company?
Yeah, it was done by Love Productions, but I think they were it was the British production team that like worked on it. Yes. I could be wrong, but like as far as I know, it was the British production house. Or rather the British production arm of Love Productions.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's been fantastic talking to you, Vim, about our plans for this year. We're releasing the first episode of Mukbang Mashup today. Awesome. So go to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/C/coconuts TV, and we're going to be releasing that shortly. Subscribe if you feel so inclined. One thing I will tease as well is we are working on some show pilots ourselves that we will be looking to release in various ways and potentially sell to various places. So that's very exciting, and that's all I can say about that for now. But keep your eyes peeled for more news on that. As we mentioned last week, we have removed our paywall on coconuts.co for all coronavirus coverage. We thought that was important to make that information and those stories available to all during this challenging time. But we still need your support, and we really appreciate it if you feel so inclined to sign up and become a Coco Plus member, which you can do at coconuts.co/membership, or become a patron and give us a patron payment, all of which supports the stories that we tell on Coconuts, the videos that we produce, this podcast. We're really pushing audience revenue, and for those who have already become members or become patrons, we really appreciate it. That's it for us today, folks, and we will check in with you and have another episode next Friday.
Awesome.
Thanks. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye, guys.